Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz, WHCL Hamilton College, Radio Lillooet, British Columbia, and Upstart Radio Online.
I love this place enough to have no doubt. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to the 49th episode of Third Paradigm, thirdparadigm.org. Our title this week is The Student Loan Mafia. Our focus will be on a book by Alan Michael Colling called The Student Loan Scam. He's the founder of the political action group StudentLoanJustice.org. I first discovered them on Change.org. In the run-up to the presidential election, Change.org had a contest where users submitted ideas for policies that Obama should implement. The three ideas that received the top number of votes would be presented to Obama. I threw into the virtual hat some ideas about foreign policy and tax relocalization, but they were eclipsed by the overwhelming crush of people wanting absolution for student loans. At first, this annoyed me. After all, they signed up for them. We all had student loans. Stop sniveling and get to work. But then I started reading some of the stories. I found hardworking, responsible people who'd been ensnared in a web of debt they could never escape. I read about the draconian collection methods they'd been subjected to, and I thought, that can't be legal. But at StudentLoanJustice.org, I found it was not only legal, but subsidized by our taxes and enforced by our laws. The proof is in the data, so I ordered the student loan scam to get the details. It starts off with the author's story. To graduate with 3 degrees in aerospace engineering, he acquired about $38,000 in debt. By the time he graduated, this had become $50,000. He became a research scientist at Caltech, earning $35,000, with 20% of his salary repaying his loan. By the summer of 2001, to make ends meet, he decided to find a more lucrative job in the defense industry. He made the mistake of resigning from Caltech when the unforeseen event of 9/11 put a chill on hiring, and he was left without a job. He applied for an economic hardship forbearance, which Sallie Mae denied. They put his loan into default the next day, demanding the immediate payment of $60,000. Without work in his field, he took restaurant and cooking jobs, working 92 hours a week at less than minimum wage. By 2002, the collection agency was demanding $80,000 as immediate payment in full. The next 2 years, he worked for a nonprofit at $36,000, while his debt ballooned to $103,000. Collection calls added verbal assaults, intimidation, and humiliation. If only to prove their claims wrong, he worked obsessively, weekends and holidays, at no extra pay. In 2004, something snapped, and he started doing research. He found that Sallie Mae's stock rose 1,700% in the decade of 1995 to 2005. A major reason was the lobbying campaign that had stripped away the most basic consumer protections, including bankruptcy, repayment ceilings, truth in lending, and the right to refinance. They were given the power to garnish wages, Social Security, and disability benefits without even a court order. They could suspend professional licenses and terminate public employment. Because of subsidies, they made more from defaulted loans than loans in good standing. Executives had amassed fortunes that enabled Sallie Mae's CEO to bid $480 million to buy a baseball team. The Department of Education's Office of Federal Student Aid was run by ex-executives of student loan companies, with stock gifts and kickbacks greasing the skids at every level. Armed with this information, Alan started a website telling his own story and coaxed a few others to tell theirs. Like Rick, a laborer from California, who went to borrow $1,500 for automotive school. When they tried to get him to sign 2 promissory notes for the same loan, he got suspicious and canceled the loan. 5 years later, his tax return was garnished for a loan balance of $3,500. Petra, a Harvard grad who left law school with $40,000 in loans in '86. After a prolonged unemployment, she filed for bankruptcy, where a debt settlement was struck. But when the law changed in '98 and disallowed bankruptcy for student loans, creditors revived the dead loan and started hounding her for a whopping $152,000. Her husband ended up divorcing her because of the harassment and the threat to his own assets. These stories aren't flukes, but are part of a calculated strategy. One of the collection companies proudly displays a shark tank in their lobby to illustrate their corporate culture. But this shouldn't shock us. Getting rich is the American dream the educational system promotes. What should outrage us, however, is that Congress has been bought by the loan sharks. But before we raise our blood pressure, let's hear the poets, philosophers, and mystics remind us what college should be about. This is Hafiz, Epictetus, and Bokanon. The music is The Keeper by Bonobo. All the hemispheres. Leave the familiar for a while. Let your senses and bodies stretch out like a welcome season onto the meadows and shores and hills. Open up to the roof. Make a new watermark on your excitement and love. Like a blooming night flower, bestow your vital fragrance of happiness and giving upon our intimate assembly. Change rooms in your mind for a day. All the hemispheres in existence lie beside an equator in your heart. Greet yourself in your thousand other forms as you mount the hidden tide and travel back home. All the hemispheres in heaven are sitting around a fire chatting while stitching themselves together into the great circle inside of you. Hafiz, from The Subject Tonight is Love, Versions of Hafiz by Daniel Ledinsky. Of being, caretake this moment. Immerse yourself in its particulars. Respond to this person, this challenge, this deed. Quit the evasions. Stop giving yourself needless trouble. It is time to really live, to fully inhabit the situation you happen to be in now. You are not some disinterested bystander. Exert yourself. Respect your partnership with Providence. Ask yourself often, how may I perform this particular deed such that it would be consistent with and acceptable to the divine will? Heed the answer and get to work. When your doors are shut and your room is dark, you are not alone. The will of nature is within you, as your natural genius is within. Listen to its importunings, follow its directives. As concerns the art of living, the material is your own life. No great thing is created suddenly. There must be time. Give your best, and always be kind. From Epictetus, The Art of Living, a new interpretation by Sharon LaBelle. Life is a garden, not a road. We enter and exit through the same gate, wandering. Where we go matters less than what we notice. Bokanon from The Lost Book. That was Bonobo with the instrumental version of The Keeper from the CD of the same name. All the Hemispheres is by Hafiz, the 14th century Persian poet. Care Take This Moment is by Epictetus, a Stoic philosopher born as a Roman slave in 55 CE from what's now called Turkey. He taught that events are beyond our control, but we're responsible for our actions, and that humans have a duty of care to all fellow humans. Suffering comes from trying to control the uncontrollable, or from neglecting what's within our power. Brutus of Etu infamy was also a Stoic, which I learned from my daughter when we watched Julius Caesar at Shakespeare Santa Cruz. I've developed new sympathy for Brutus and for Julius Caesar, two sides of a worthy coin. The last quote is by Bokanon, a fictional character in Kurt Vonnegut's novel Cat's Cradle. The religion he starts, called Bokanism, says that all religions are formed entirely of lies. But if you adhere to a useful set of lies, you'll live a good life. He coined several unique terms. A group of people who unknowingly work together to do God's will is called a carass. The purpose they serve together is called their whampeter. When a person dies, they find out what their whampeter was and all the many ways they served it and who was in their carass. A grand falloon, however, is a carass without a whampeter, a group of people who imagine they have a connection that doesn't really exist. Some examples are the Hoosiers and the Daughters of the American Revolution, plus all nations everywhere. Busy, busy, busy is what the Bokanonists whisper whenever they're struck by the interconnectedness of life. Before we return to the topic of student loans, I'd like to examine the concept of daylight saving time and ask whether it really saves time or steals it. When I wake my kids up for school these days in the pitch dark, I tell them that October is the cruelest month. Elsewhere, daylight saving time is called summertime. How has summer come to include all of October and start in mid-March, getting up an hour earlier for 7.5 months? It gives a new meaning to March Madness. Let's look at its history from a site called webexhibits.org. Although Benjamin Franklin conceived of the idea, it was a London builder named William Willett who spent his fortune trying to force his own early morning enjoyment on other people. As a wealthy financier, he spent mornings riding through the woods, not going to work. When asked why he didn't just get up an hour earlier, he gave the astute response, "What?" His campaign was met by ridicule and opposition during his lifetime, especially by farmers. Perhaps they felt for their kids, who were finally getting some light to do their farm chores by before they went to school. During World War I, Parliament passed a law that clocks should be set back for 5 months beginning April 30th. But when it was adopted in the U.S. in 1918, it had grown to 7 months. It proved so unpopular that it was repealed in 1919 with a congressional override of President Wilson's veto. During World War II, Roosevelt instituted wartime and turned the clocks back year-round, but it was voted out again in 1945. In 1947, Robertson Davies noted, "I object to being told that I am saving daylight when my reason tells me that I am doing nothing of the kind. I even object to the implication that I am wasting something valuable if I stay in bed after the sun has risen. As an admirer of moonlight, I resent the bossy insistence of those who want to reduce my time for enjoying it. At the back of the daylight saving scheme, I detect the bony, blue-fingered hand of Puritanism, eager to push people into bed sooner and get them up earlier to make them healthy, wealthy, and wise in spite of themselves." By 1966, Congress signed the Uniform Time Act to get us all up earlier 6 months of the year. But the states could still keep standard time if they chose. In 1974 and 1975, Nixon upped the ante to 10 months of the year. 3 decades later, in 2007, the Energy Policy Act extended daylight saving time from March until November, although Congress retained the right to revert should the change prove unpopular or if energy savings are not significant. Let's look at this. In Indiana, until it was legislated statewide, only 16% of counties observed it. Indiana then ended up spending $8.6 million more for energy, due to air conditioners and TVs. Another claim has been that it decreases evening traffic accidents. But pedestrian fatalities soar at 6 p.m. in the weeks following the change back to standard time. Instead of a gradual adjustment, drivers are thrown suddenly into an early dusk, the most dangerous of driving times. The candy lobby pushed for November instead of an October end date on the self-serving grounds that daylight would be safer for kids to trick-or-treat. But it backfired because kids still waited until dark. Well, duh. But daylight also encourages people to shop or eat out instead of staying home. And then there's the extra work by salaried employees, who come in early and still work until dark. I think we've been snookered out of our sleep. If we have to get up early, it should be for only half the year, not two-thirds. Let's answer the bony finger of Puritanism with a finger of our own. Take back the night. Let's break for a song by Modest Mouse called Miss the Boat.
Could we change the subject now? I was knocking on your ears, don't be you were always out. Looking towards the future, we were begging for the past. Well, we know we had the good things, but those never seem to last. Oh, please just last. Everyone's unhappy, everyone's ashamed. Well, we all just got caught looking at somebody else's page. Well, nothing ever went quite exactly as we planned. Our ideas held no water, but we used them like a dam.
Oh, and we carried it all so well.
Everyone goes crazy over such and such and such. We made ourselves a pillar, but we just used it as a crutch. We were certainly uncertain, at least I'm pretty sure I am. Well, we didn't need the water, but we just built that good goddamn.
That was Modest Mouse with Missed the Boat from their CD, We Were Dead Before the Ship Even Sank. It makes me wonder if Modest Mouse had student loans. Let's examine how it got to this. In 1972, Nixon established the Student Loan Marketing Association, or Sallie Mae, as a government-sponsored agency. He increased loans and grant aid to students while defunding higher education. In the 90s, however, an ambitious CEO named Albert Lord privatized Sallie Mae but kept the subsidies. He gave kickbacks to universities if they made Sallie Mae their preferred lender. He gave perks to financial aid officials, like trips to exotic places, golf outings, parties, and even stock. Family members were given jobs. Federal direct loans, which were cheaper for the taxpayer, were strangled while Sallie Mae received enhanced subsidies. They started buying up all parts of the process, collection agencies and guarantors who were supposed to oversee the process. By 2006, they were four times the size of their closest competitor, Citibank. Their private student loans could charge interest rates approaching 30%. Using their clout in Congress, legislation allowed for massive penalties and fees for delinquent debt, which made it more profitable when students defaulted than when they paid. Student loans became the only type of debt to be non-dischargeable in bankruptcy, no matter what hardship was proven, which was expanded to include private loans at exorbitant interest. All statutes of limitations were eliminated, so old loans from the 70s and 80s became new collectible debt. They were exempt from state usury laws and the Truth in Lending Act. Guarantors could ignore the Fair Debt Collection and Practices Act when pursuing defaulted borrowers. It became impossible to tell where the university ended and the student loan companies began. Lenders gave hundreds of thousands in university donations and then ran call centers staffed with their own employees masquerading as the college's financial aid department. University nonprofits held hundreds of thousands of lender stock shares, which would gain or lose value depending on whose loan they promoted. Federal direct loans disappeared from these colleges' options. Financial aid directors were given lucrative fees for consulting with lenders. One section of the book, called Larry Loves Tequila, outlines other methods. But perhaps the deepest cut of all was legislation that required a lender to consolidate their loans with the original lender and never leave, even if other lenders offered better terms. For a short time, a loophole was found called the Super Two-Step, and borrowers rushed to refinance their debt. But the head of the House Education Committee, John Bonner, then received the largest amount of student loan PAC money, and his daughter got a job with a subsidiary of Sallie Mae. And so the loophole was closed. There are reasons they didn't want students to pay off their loans. Legislation provided for collection rates of up to 25% to be added to the debt as soon as it went into default. Congress provided the loan guarantors and collection companies with powers that would make a mobster envious, according to Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren. They included wage, Social Security, and disability garnishment, tax seizure, suspension of state-issued professional licenses, and termination of public employment. Full permanent disability was the only circumstance under which the loan could be absolved, but it then showed up as taxable income, fully burdened with fees and interest, so the tax payment was more than the original loan. So where are we now? There are more than 5 million defaulted student loans on record with the U.S. Department of Education, totaling $40 billion. Millions of more graduates have bought their way out of penalties and fees to be just barely out of default. The stories range from those resentful of not being able to refinance to those who decided that life wasn't worth living under this insurmountable weight. Increasing numbers are coming forward who've been driven out of the country, while an untold number have gone off-grid, working under the radar. The student loan scam does end on a hopeful note. The grassroots movement it started instigated the Student Borrower Bill of Rights. Alan Colling outlines solutions and where they are in process. He also gives practical advice that's worth the $23 as a graduation present for any high school senior. But the key underlying problem is reducing the price tag for college. In the following episodes, I'll be exploring a paradigm shift, moving from degree-driven education to a decentralized credentialing system based on the model of Wikipedia. This has been Teresa Caraggia with Third Paradigm. Thanks to Skidmark Bob for production, music, and editing, and to Mike Sirocco for enhancing the transcript with graphics, videos, and links. Last week's episode now has a video from Al Jazeera on changing channels, and one called White Gold on Child Labor in Uzbekistan Cotton. Check it out at thirdparadigm.org. Our last song is by Jason Mraz. It's called Details in the Fabric, and it's dedicated to all those who can't see a way out. Keep the faith.
Saved message.
Hey, what's up? My whole entire life.
get yourself dressed instead of running around and pulling on your threads and breaking yourself up. If it's a broken part, replace it. If it's a broken arm, then brace it. If it's a broken heart, then face it. And hold your own, know your name, and go your own way. Hold your own, know your name.
Nature's so